Once again, the five steps that hurt him, the steps of interpretation in order to get what you're reading correctly in the Bible. We did historical, cultural, and contextual analysis last week. We're in step two, the horrible lexical, syntactical analysis. Last week was the historical, cultural, was studying the elements of history, culture, and contextual. Context may shed light on God's intended meaning. That can be kind of interesting. Unfortunately, this week is studying the words, lexicology, and the way the author related these words to each other, the syntax to help you better understand the author's intended meaning. In other words, we're into the like dictionary type things. Alexander Carson, if you know who he is, seminarian, a professor. He's actually a pretty smart guy. Anyway, he said, "No man has a right to say, as some are in the habit of saying, the Spirit tells me that such or such is the meaning of a passage." So you can read something and you really can't say, "The Spirit tells me that this is what it means," because you can't be assured that it is the Holy Spirit that says that this is what it means, because you can't be assured that it's the Holy Spirit that is it, and not a spirit of delusion. Because it is, the evidence should be... So anyway, this is a complicated process. Oh no, yeah. It involves working with Hebrew, Greek, Aramaic, and even English, which is hard for many of us, including me tonight, apparently. Steps in the lexical syntactical analysis. There are five steps. You wish to write these down, you can on the back of that sheet. You need to identify the general literary form that you are reading. The second step will be to trace the development of the author's theme and show how the passage under consideration fits in the context. In other words, just figure out the theme and figure out where it's going. These five steps will actually be in the headings on some of these too, so there will be things underneath too. So you don't have to write this big long thing word for word. I'll highlight these things. Just, you want to figure out the author's theme and figure out how he's developing it. Next ones, you want to identify the natural divisions in the text. Figure out the connecting words in his paragraphs and sentences. And then figure out what those individual words mean. So those five steps are your basic outline in this. Okay, so figure out your general literary form. Literary forms of writing show the ways that the author meant the words to be interpreted. So you have, in general, as far as we're concerned here, I mean, if you want to really get into it, there are more than three basic forms of literature in the Bible, but generally, all we're concerned here with are prose, poetry, and apocalyptic forms. Apocalyptic forms would be like Daniel and Revelation. But for instance, David says, "I fill my bed with tears." That's poetry. He obviously doesn't really mean he filled his bed completely with tears. Okay, you read poetry a little bit differently than you do prose. Like Genesis, I mean, Noah didn't fill his bed with tears. God did it. Now we go to the author's theme. Similar to contextual analysis, it's very like we did last week. The author's theme helps pin down his definitions. You do kind of word studies and grammar. It gets really boring. If you're looking for an exciting time, this is not it. When you get to the natural divisions of a text, I underline this therefore for a reason, you'll see in a little bit. Figuring out the natural divisions of the text reveals the author's thought process. Going through Romans is it's very easy to figure out the natural divisions of the text if you remember. How long ago did we do Romans? Did we do that a while ago? Not that long.
It took almost a year.
Yeah, but you know, Romans is pretty easy to get the divisions of the text in that. Paul does really well with it. Now I'm going to go with chapter and verse divisions in our Bibles today. Were not part of the original manuscripts. Anybody know how our chapter and verse divisions were actually done for the most part? Well, the Jews, they'd done it in the Old Testament quite a bit in order to help keep track of when they were doing copying manuscript to manuscript. But particularly with Protestants later, I can't remember his name, but there was a guy who was, he's riding his horse and he's going down the road and he was using a pen and he's going along and he just basically put numbers along and it was going like this, and when his horse would make a step, he was trying to do it in sentences, but every once in a while you'll notice that there was a verse division and it wasn't necessarily in a sentence. And that's when he'd slip up when his horse would stumble. And so sometimes it doesn't make sense. And that's just what, it's a true story. So that's where sometimes it just doesn't make sense. And he would try to make some of the Old Testament ones match up with where the Jews did it, but sometimes it doesn't. And that's part of the reason why. So it's haphazard. So that's one reason why they don't make a whole lot of sense. Down here I have a note that some translations encourage unintentionally out-of-context interpretations due to printing style. The King James, if you'll notice, if you have one of the original King James, what they call the Authorized Version, when it was printed verse by verse, almost like every verse is its own paragraph. That makes a very unnatural reading, and that encourages out of context. They weren't intending you to read out of context, but it makes it very easy to read things not in a natural way. And you'll find a lot of you'll hear people call them King James only churches, the ones that will only read the King James Bible. They will quote verses in such a way that they take them out of context. By the way, I'll pass this around. This is a lithograph copy of an original King James version. Just to take a look at it, it's very interesting. Some of the more observant people will probably have some questions afterward. Just peruse it, go around. You probably won't see any, probably never seen a version like it. It's a copy of an actual print version from 1611. But anyway, you'll see that modern versions today have the divisions according to the actual paragraphs. They've been divided up like we would actually speak today. So it keeps context a little bit better now. Connecting words. Those are conjunctions, prepositions, and relative pronouns. And what are those? They show a relationship between two sections of material or two of the author's thoughts. Those would be words like for, because, and therefore. Why I underline those. You notice Paul in Romans particularly uses the word therefore, or what we would translate as therefore, all the time. Whenever you see the word therefore, you are to ask, what is it? Therefore. You've all heard that. Okay. Good. Okay. Word meanings, denotations and connotations. More stupid long words. What do these mean? Denotations would be like what is a dictionary definition for a word. Connotations are kind of like what are the implied definitions of a word. Not a dictionary definition, but kind of what do people think of when they hear a word. three ways to find the denotations of word. You would see how people use the word elsewhere in secular being not religious, and religious literature of the time. You'd study synonyms, looking for points of comparison and contrast, synonyms being other words that mean basically the same thing, looking for what words mean roughly the same thing, and how do they, how are they similar in some ways, and how are they different in other words? And etymology is how do words change over time. For instance, points of comparison and contrast. Greek has a number of words that mean love, what we would translate as love. We have not very many words for the word love, but Greek has a couple. For instance, in John, they use the word phileo and agapao. They have, there's a lot of different scholars will say that phileo and agapao are complete synonyms, and others will say no, there's a difference between the two, and I'm not going to take a position on it right now, but just realize that depending on which particular biblical author is using the word, they might use the word exactly the same, and others might use them a little bit differently. You just have to, depending on what book you're looking at, there might be a difference. It's technical, which is another reason why this can be a pretty hard subject. Tools for discovering denotations: concordances, theological workbooks, and other tools. This is where I'm going to start hauling out all the incredible, wonderful things that you don't have to actually have anymore, because we have computers now. These are all the things I didn't sell. If you want to take a look at all this stuff now that you don't have to have, because we have the internet and we have computers. We have a Hebrew Bible, got a Greek Bible. Here's a Hebrew English lexicon. Here's a Greek Old Testament, a Greek Old Testament dictionary, a Greek New Testament dictionary, a couple Greek grammar books, a Homeric Greek dictionary.
I like something better. But where's the Aramaic
one? No. Actually, the Greek or the Hebrew dictionary has Aramaic in it. Here's an interpreter's Bible. Yeah.
What is this?
That's a Greek New Testament.
Oh.
With that one's got a.
There's no picture.
No pictures? Well, there's maps in the back.
That's that one.
This one here is Bullinger's Figures of Speech Used in the Bible. Well, there are other references that are out there that are fairly decent too. But I mean, to be honest, with the internet and computer references, I mean, these are all great for when the world all falls apart and the electrons go away. But right now, with everything that's on your iPads and your computers, well, because we aren't Roman Catholic and need the Vulgate anymore. But if you're going to learn, if you want to read Greek, actually, you really want to use this stuff. Because if you're doing it on the computer, you don't learn it good doing it on the computer. You cheat too easy.
So what's the problem?
It you just don't learn it as good going through it on the computer. And I knew a guy when I was in Tennessee who grew up. He grew up Jewish, and he converted, but being Jewish, of course, it was just natural for him to become a Seventh-day Adventist. And asked him how long it took him or how hard it was to learn Hebrew, when he said, because he grew up Jewish, he said, I don't know, I'll let you know when I learn it. He said it was just impossible, and he grew up speaking Hebrew, and he still had trouble with it. But I'll let you just go ahead and peruse those things while we go on through here. But I mean, if you're interested in actually, the computer software stuff and all that will still run you money. It'll still cost you some bucks. For instance, that one that Jack's holding right there, that book, run you almost $200. And the computer program that's the or book for that, roughly the same amount still for that. So you're not going to save much by getting it on digital anyway. Okay, back to this. Discovering author's intended denotation. Usually when an author uses a word, he intends a single meaning each time he uses the word. The most helpful guide is the context that he uses it in. So context is always the most important thing. For example, even today in English, I just get off the Gravitron at the fair. You talk to Tina and she says that I'm looking very green. Now I'm a 5'7", 180-pound asparagus, and I'm avoiding a den of rabbits in my backyard, or had you better get me a bucket. Yeah, probably better get me a bucket. Best clue when you're reading the Bible is you look several verses before and after the passage in question. The second most important thing, you look at the definitions or explanatory phrases that the author himself gives. For example, look at 2 Timothy 3:16-17. I've included it here because this is kind of a long thing. What does perfect mean in the King James Version? Paul says that perfect means thoroughly furnished unto all good works. If you want to look up 2 Timothy 3:16-17, Paul defines what perfect means immediately after using the word, that it means perfect, is thoroughly furnished unto all good works. Third most important thing, subject and predicate may explain each other. Grammar, ick. Just forget this one for now. It's harder to explain than to actually do it. Fourth most important thing, look at parallelism if it occurs within a passage. Parallelism, we're talking about poetry here. One-third of the Old Testament is poetry. Some of the New Testament, major characteristic of Hebrew poetry is parallelism.
Which portion of the New Testament is poetry?
There's not very much.
Okay, so
not very much.
Give me an example.
I can't remember right now. Maybe some of the songs.
Jude?
Maybe some of Jude. There's very, very little of it. Some of the songs. Song of Mary, maybe?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe
yeah.
You're right.
Yeah, like I said, very, very little of it.
Yeah.
There may be some of Revelation, too. Very little of that. But for the most part, it's mostly Old Testament. But three types of Hebrew parallelism. You've got synonymous, where the second line repeats the content of the first, but in different words. Psalms 103:10. He does not treat us as our sins deserve, or repay us according to our iniquities. See lines 1 and 2. Just say the same thing in different words. Then there's antithetic, where it sharply contrasts each other. The wicked borrow and do not repay, but the righteous give generously. And the third kind is synthetic. second line carries further supposed to be idea of the first. Lord looks down from heaven on the sons of men to see if there are any who understand, any who seek God. Fifth most important thing, decide whether the author is using a figure of speech. That's where Bullinger's figure of speech. Sometimes the authors use words or phrases in ways that deviate from normal speech in order to produce a vivid impression. One thing that's important with Bullinger's there, I think I've got a note in here later. Bullinger's is a good reference if you're using it. However, realize that it is just Bullinger's opinion. However, his opinion is probably more valid than any of ours, because he did know Greek and Hebrew very well, whereas most of us don't. The author, realize with a figure of speech, the author does not intend a literal interpretation in this case, but obviously care must be taken here, because we are using our own judgment to decide whether the author was using a figure of speech and did not intend a literal interpretation. So remember that our default is that the author is intending a literal interpretation. Remember that a lot of the trouble that we have today is that so many people think that the Bible is not to be interpreted literally, which is where we get into so many ridiculous interpretations. So always default to a literal interpretation, and you better have a good reason for thinking that it's not to be literally interpreted. You got to be able to back it up with something extremely reasonable. You got to have a good reason for it. Not just because I don't think so. Figures of speech have to have a really good reason. You got to take real good care there. Six, study parallel passages. An obscure word or phrase may be used in a more clear passage. It's important, though, to distinguish between verbal parallels and real parallels. Sort of spirit is one of them, where there are verbal parallels. Ephesians 6 and Galatians 4. Can't remember right now. They both talk about sort of the spirit, but different ideas. So those would be verbal parallels where they use the same words but different ideas. Verbal parallels are those that use similar words but are discussing different ideas, whereas real parallels speak of the same idea or event. So if you're trying to figure out words, make sure that you're looking at the same ideas. Syntax, ick. We're nearing the end of this horrible, horrible lecture, I'm sorry. Syntax is the most difficult step without a knowledge of Greek or Hebrew or Aramaic. Realize that English is an analytic language where word order is very important. Hebrew is also an analytic language, but not as much so. Greek is what's called a synthetic language, where word order is not so important. That's kind of one of the neat things about Greek. I like Greek. I like Greek food. I like food. Greek is neat in that a single Greek word can be an entire sentence. It is really cool that way. You can take a Greek word and you just change the prefix and the suffix and you change the entire word. Just one word can be an entire sentence. And you can change one part of it and the whole mood of it changes completely. And it has that mood can't even be translated into English in certain ways. I can't even explain it. It comes alive in a different way that English can't be translated. It's just cool. But anyway. And then when you add more words into a Greek sentence, it becomes much more full. If you change the word order in Greek, then you change emphasis, kind of. And you can, if you want to emphasize something in Greek, you can change the word order to maybe put something at the front, or you can emphasize it by putting it towards the back. But you won't necessarily change the meaning that much. In English, obviously, you can throw everything completely out of whack and people look at you like you're an idiot if you change the word order. But in Greek, it doesn't matter much. So that's just kind of, it's an interesting language. Hebrew is a real bizarre language. Hebrew is extremely context sensitive. It's really complicated. The definition of a Hebrew word, you can't just take a Hebrew word out of context and know what it means. You have to see the word in context to know the definition of the word. You've got to practically be a professor of Hebrew to have a clue what that word means. It's atrocious in order to figure out, which is why I have it in one semester of the book.
What is the interlinear Bible?
An interlinear Bible? I don't know where my thing is. An interlinear Bible is where they'll have one line of English and then one line of Hebrew or Greek. One line of English and then the translation of Hebrew or Greek underneath it. They'll have the words as close to where they're supposed to be underneath it. So it can be kind of helpful if you're trying to figure out what word is supposed to be what from English to Greek or English to Hebrew. Analytical lexicons. Did I have one in here? No, that's just an analytical lexicon looks almost like a printed out computer program. It's where they've got, anybody here remember what a conjugation is? I see a couple of people shaking their head with a smirk on their face. Yeah, conjugate the verb, whatever. Yeah, pretty horrible. Ich bin, er, sie, es, yeah, all that awful stuff. One of the best things I ever sold was this book that was literally a computer printout of every word, every Greek word in the Septuagint that printed out from a computer program. And it had every word, every possible conjugation of everything. It was awful. So it was every single word in the Old Testament Greek. And every time, every number that it was listed in the Bible. And I can't imagine why somebody would want this unless they were just afraid that all the electrical power is going to go down in the world and they might possibly need this somewhere. And it was only in print like once every 10 years. I don't know why they want it. But I sold it on Amazon. Somebody bought it for like $80. Like, I was happy to get rid of it. So, yeah. But that's what an analytical lexicon does. It just lists every word in every possible conjugation. Ick. The length of the books that we've got are normally about the length of one scroll.
Yeah.
And I want to. I think they were roughly about 40 feet long.
That long?
I think they were about 40 feet.